Welcome to today's program titled Preparing for Predictive Scheduling, How to Get Your Business Ready for July 1st. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. At the end of today's event, a link to an online evaluation will be displayed on your screen. Please take a few moments to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. I would now like to introduce our hosts for today's call, Leah Lively and Brent Hamilton. Leah, you may begin.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the webinar, or good afternoon if you are in a different time zone that is later than we are. Today we're going to be talking about the basics of the new Oregon Predictive Scheduling Law and how to get your business ready for the July 1st date by which BOLI, the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries, is going to start enforcing penalties. I am a partner in the Davis Wright Tremaine Portland office, and I am joined by my colleague Brent Hamilton, who will be giving part of this presentation as well. Both of us are specialists in employment law, both advice, counseling, and litigation. So let's get started with what the purpose of predictive scheduling law. Contrary to what many employers probably feel, the purpose of the law is not to create more administrative busy work for employers, although it certainly is going to do that. The purpose of the law is to create predictable work shifts for employees where they have advance notice and flexibility. The predictive scheduling law is designed to help employees who may work one or more part-time jobs, maybe have medical appointments, have childcare arrangements that cannot be changed late in the day or late in the week, or maybe have vacation or something otherwise planned. So there are a lot of good reasons for the predictive scheduling laws. Today we're going to be going over the basics of Oregon's predictive scheduling requirements with you. What are those basics? First, that the employer is required to provide a good faith estimate of the work schedule for new employees, and as you will hear, this is before the first day of employment. Second, for existing covered employees, the employer has to provide advance notice of their work schedule. Third, the employer has to give the employees a rest between work shifts, and as we'll discuss later, this is different than split shifts. So if an employee is working a split shift, that is something different. This is a right to rest between two different shifts. Fourth, we're going to discuss record-keeping requirements pursuant to the new law and regulations. And last, we'll go over what are some of the penalties that can be enforced by the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries, otherwise known as BOLI. So let's start off with who is covered from an employer perspective, because not all employers are covered by this law. The employers who are covered are employers that have at least 500 employees. Now, the interesting thing about this is the 500 employees are not just in Oregon, they are worldwide. So if your company has 500 or more employees worldwide, including chains and integrated enterprises, that employer will be covered. However, the law is industry specific. It looks at something called the North American Industry Classification System, and here we have it as NAICS. The industries that are specifically covered by this new law are retail establishments, food service establishments, and hospitality establishments. So think retail, shopping, food service, restaurant, and hospitality is going to be hotels and motels. Unfortunately, it's unclear what it is meant to be, quote, classified, end quote, under the NAICS. For example, there is a hospital example given in BOLI's final rules. And although a hospital in and of itself wouldn't be something that we would consider a hospitality or a food service or a retail establishment, it may be considered classified because it's sort of a hybrid. Does the hospital include a food service establishment, or does it include hospitality factors? so that's something that is something that we're going to need to have fleshed out as this law comes into effect. I see some questions are popping up. We're going to get those questions at the end of the presentation so that we have a chance to get through everything, and we will get the questions in the order they are presented, or if we see several questions on the same topic. So who is covered from an employee perspective? Let's say that you are a retail establishment, so you know with more than 500 employees worldwide, so you know you're going to be covered. Which of your employees are covered? Generally, all of your hourly employees are going to be covered. So employees who are providing services related to the covered industry. So if you have employees working on the floor of your retail establishment, if you have servers in your restaurant, or if you have front desk people at a hotel. So this would apply to waiters, housekeepers, and cashiers for the business in that industry. It would not, however, apply to somebody like a human resources manager because, one, that person is going to be considered administrative exempt, and secondly, they are not providing a service related to the covered industry. In other words, they're providing human resources services and not retail-type services. So if we go down to this second bullet, the employees who are not covered by the new rules include exempt employees, and that's employees who are exempt under administrative, executive, or professional exemptions, a worker supplied by a licensed worker leasing company, and this is really important here that it has to be this licensed, a licensed worker leasing company. Those people would not be covered by the new statute, or employees of a non-covered business contracted with your company to provide services on your company's behalf. So, for example, let's say that you are a restaurant in the restaurant or retail industry, and you contract with a janitorial service to come in and clean your restaurant every night. Those employees from that company, which are not your employees, but those employees from that company would not be considered to be covered by this law. They're janitorial. They're not the retail or the food service or hospitality. What about unions or employees covered by collective bargaining agreement? Oregon's predictive scheduling law applies to employees covered by collective bargaining agreements unless the employee is covered by a CBA that is in force at the time at the employee's work site and that provides the employee a remedy equal to or better than the remedy provided by Oregon's predictive scheduling law. So what this is going to mean is that if you are a union employer and you have employees covered by the predictive scheduling law, chances are next time you're at the bargaining table, you're going to have to work in information or remedies if there's a change in those employees' schedules, because they're going to be covered by the predictive scheduling laws unless their collective bargaining agreement is equal to or better than what is offered as a remedy, which you'll see is pay for those employees down the line. I'm now going to turn it over to Brent, who is going to be going through some of the additional requirements.
Thanks, Leah. So, as Leah kind of mentioned at the beginning, there are really three main requirements that the predictive scheduling law imposes on employers. The first is the good faith estimate of the work schedule that's given to new employees. The second is the ongoing advance schedule notice requirement that you have to continually provide employees with advance notice of what their actual schedule is going to be. And the third right created by the predictive scheduling law is the right for employees to rest from one day to the next. So Leah's going to discuss that in a little bit. The first component is the good faith estimate of the work schedule. So this is something that's given to a new employee, and what the content of the good faith estimate of work schedule, typically I think that employers will be offering a form, or this will be part of an onboarding package that you'll give to a new employee. And the law requires that the employer tell the new employee what the median number of hours in an average one-month period that that employee might expect to work in this position that they're being offered. So the median number is not a range. And employers might think it might be more helpful to provide a range because there might be some variance in the employee's schedule, but the rules that Bowley's published clarify that the median is a number. It's a single number. It can't be a range of numbers. I think that it's also important to note that this is offered in a one-month period. It's not a quarterly or a weekly estimate. This is an average one-month estimate. So the good faith estimate of the work schedule also has to explain if the employer chooses to use a voluntary standby list. And we'll talk about the voluntary standby list procedure, but if you as the employer elect to have a voluntary standby list, you need to let the employee know on their good faith estimate of work schedule form. Finally, you have to explain if you as an employer utilize on-call shifts, you have to explain to the employee when they might be expected to be called in to work when they're on an on-call shift. So what are the objective circumstances that might lead to an employee on the on-call shift being called in to actually work a shift? And you'll have to explain that clearly in the good faith estimate of work schedule at the time of hire. So this is the when, I think, is the critical question on the good faith estimate of work schedule form. I think that most employers will develop a form, and it will become fairly easy for them to provide that. It's just a critical decision about deciding when in the onboarding process you're going to provide this form. So the law requires that the form is provided at the time of hire. The law defines that at the time of hire is sometime after an offer of employment and the acceptance of the offer, but it's before the commencement of employment. So I think that employers have to think about what their onboarding process looks like and when in their onboarding process would be after an offer and acceptance of that offer and before the employee actually starts working. That's the window when you have to provide this good faith estimate of work schedule form. So the final point that I'll note from this slide is the language that the form should be provided in. I think that it should be provided in English, almost certainly. But if you, as an employer, typically communicate with your employees in another language, then you're also required to provide the form in that language or the disclosure in that language. So I think that that's an employer-to-employer specific question, but something to watch out for as well. Sorry, I'm having trouble navigating the PowerPoint presentation. So the next component of the predictive scheduling law is the advance notice of the work schedule. So this is, I think, the toughest requirement or the most onerous requirement for employers is to provide advance notice of everybody's actual work schedule. And when I say everybody, to be clear, I mean the covered employees that Leah already identified. So how soon or how far in advance do we have to provide employees with their actual work schedule? Well, beginning on July 1st, the notice period is 7 days. So if you begin a shift next Monday, I have to provide you with notice at least this Monday in order to provide adequate notice under the law. In 2020, July 1st, 2020, that notice period increases to 14 days. So you're required to give your employees 2 weeks notice as of July 1st, 2020, of their actual work schedule. So what might be covered in a work schedule? A work schedule could be a one-week schedule. It could be a one-month schedule. The time covered by the schedule, it could be set by the employer, but the key thing is that you just have to provide adequate notice in advance of the first day that the employee begins working. There are some employees that might be difficult to provide them with 7 or 14 days notice of their actual work schedule, and so the law has a couple exceptions for new employees and for employees returning from leave. So for a new employee, you still have to provide them with their actual work schedule, but you have to provide that on or before the first day of their work. For an existing employee, somebody who's just returning from a leave of absence, then they have to be provided with their actual work schedule on the first day of work after a leave of absence. And for these two categories, new employees and employees returning from leave, you have to provide them with a schedule from that time through the end of whatever the posted noticed schedule is. So it's just catching them up to the rest of the employees for that kind of ongoing schedule. The schedule has to be posted in a conspicuous and accessible location. So you need to give each employee their schedule, but you also have to give each employee notice of every other employee's schedule in that location. So you have to post everybody's schedule in somewhere that all of the employees can access. The law defines conspicuous and accessible to mean something that everyone can access. It could be electronic, so long as all employees are provided access to the schedule at the workplace, and so long as they can see the schedules of all employees at the same location. I think that if you're posting something on a bulletin board or in the employee break room or somewhere other that's a physical paper posting, that might take care of itself. But if you're an employer that utilizes an electronic scheduling system, you need to think about whether an employee is able to see the other employees' schedules at their work location. So I think that this is something that could facilitate works shift swaps or things like that, that employees should be able to see when other employees are working. So similar language requirement for the advance notice of work schedule. It's in English, and again, the language that the employer typically uses to communicate with employees. You do not need to provide advance notice of the work schedule if an employee requests the change. So there are, you can imagine a number of circumstances where an employee has a last minute family issue come up, or they might want to swap shifts, or they might want to be added to a newly opened shift and they come to their manager and ask for an additional shift. Those employee requested changes are not subject to the advance notice requirements, and hence are not subject to the penalty wages that apply for not giving the proper advance notice. So the penalty wages, as I just mentioned, accrue if you do not give the proper notice to an employee of their actual work schedule in the 7 or 14-day window as applicable. The one key thing about this law is that if the employer is making changes to the employee's work schedule after the notice period has already elapsed, then the employee can actually decline to work the additional hours that the employer is requesting of them. The critical thing that this law adds is a protection for the employee to decline those additional hours, that they may not be subject to discipline for refusing to request additional hours that are not properly noticed, and they can't be retaliated against for refusing to request those hours. So if they do agree to work extra time, then the employee may be entitled to extra penalty wages. If the employer adds more than 30 minutes to a shift or changes the date of the shift without a loss of hours, or if the employer schedules the employee for an additional shift, that employee is entitled to one extra hour of penalty pay. That hour of penalty pay is calculated at the employee's regular rate, which is defined by the administrative rules. And it is not an overtime hour. It is just 1 hour at the regular rate of pay. So if the employee is entitled to an overtime because, for example, you add enough time to the shift that that employee moves into the overtime bucket, the the regular rate of pay will not increase because of that overtime pay. The regular rate of pay will be calculated at the employee's base rate. So on the flip side, if you're not adding time, if you're in fact subtracting time, then the employee is entitled to half-time pay for those subtracted hours. Also, if the employer changes the date, resulting in a loss of hours, the employee is entitled to half-time pay for those hours that they are not working. Similarly, canceling the employee's shift, or if the employer doesn't call somebody in off of an on-call shift. So earlier I mentioned on the good faith estimate that you're required to kind of explain your on-call policy to the employee. So if you do call in the employee from their on-call shift, they'll get paid at their regular rate of pay. If you don't call them in, this new law requires that an on-call shift be paid half-time for the regular rate of pay. So for some employers, this might cause them to rethink whether they're going to continue using on-call shifts. And I think that that's something that might be evaluated on an employer-by-employer basis. There are some exceptions when you do not have to provide advance notice, and hence when you would not be required to pay the penalty wages that we just talked about. I'm not going to go through all of them. I tried to mirror the statute here. So the law is at the top right-hand corner of the slide, and exemptions A through K track with the predictive scheduling law. So exception A, I think, makes sense. It's changes of less than 30 minutes, so this is can you work an extra 15 minutes at the end of your shift? That's not subject to the advance notice requirements. B through D are all employee-requested changes, and I think it's typically a best practice, even if it's not required to get those employee changes in writing, I think it's a best practice for the employer to get all of those in writing as best they can. E is interesting. This is if you discipline an employee. So if you suspend an employee, that would technically be a change resulting in a loss of hours that might trigger half-time wages. Well, this exemption applies here so long as the discipline is for just cause and so long as the employer documents that time in writing. If the employer fails to have just cause or fails to document it in writing, arguably that employee might be entitled to penalty wages at half-time pay. So I think that employers, when they're going to suspend an employee without pay, need to really think carefully about the requirements of this law and make sure that they're complying with the law so that the discipline actually holds. F and G are, I think, kind of self-explanatory. H was something that Leah and I talked about when the law first came out and before the rules were published, because we said, oh no, it has to be an earthquake or a volcano for people to be able to cancel a work shift. But luckily, the administrative rules clarified that it could be something that is more common, like a snowstorm or some kind of other significant weather event or some kind of other event that causes a cancellation that's outside of an employer's control. And I think that there, I would read the administrative rule just so that you're comfortable with the requirements, but I think that it's fairly broad. I relates to those employers that deal with ticketed events. So for example, basketball games or concerts or plays, employers that are supporting those kind of events may face cancellations because the musician had laryngitis and they just couldn't perform, or some kind of other unexpected event. Well, the Oregon Predictive Scheduling Law provides an exception that the concessions stand can cancel their employees because the musician canceled the concert. So in the event of the ticketed events cancellation that's outside of the employer's control, the Oregon law provides an exception. J relates to employees who are on the voluntary standby list, working hours assigned through the voluntary standby list procedure. I'm going to talk about the voluntary standby list later in the presentation when I talk a little bit about the comparison between the Oregon and Seattle law, so I'll just kind of leave that one here. Finally, K is that employers may avoid paying or providing advance notice and hence paying the penalty wages if they're calling in employees to work to cover unanticipated customer needs or unexpected employee absences. The law provides a specific procedure for doing this. So unexpected customer needs or unexpected employee absence, the first question that Leah and I had, well, when is it supposed to be unanticipated or when is it unexpected? Helpfully, Boley's rules clarify that it's unanticipated or unexpected on the day when the schedule is posted, on the day when the employer provides the schedule. So on or before that date, was the customer need unanticipated or was the employee absence unexpected? The exception K has a kind of a three-part requirement in order to ensure compliance, in order to avoid the advance notice requirements. First, the employee has to consent in writing to work the additional hours. So in order to get this exception K to the advance notice, you have to get the employee's consent in writing. If you're an employer who chooses to use the voluntary standby list, step one is that you must have contacted all of the employees that have signed up for the voluntary standby list and that are eligible employees to work this shift. So the employer is not required to actually speak with each employee on the voluntary standby list, but they're actually required to contact or go through the list and contact all the employees on the voluntary standby list before they can move to employees who are not on the voluntary standby list. If an employer chooses not to use the voluntary standby list, then you just skip to this last bullet point, and that's communicating to employees who are not on the voluntary standby list. So the law is a little bit tricky here. If an employee is currently working a shift at the time when the employer asks the employee to cover an extra shift, then that can be an individual in-person communication. However, if the employee is not working at the time when the employer is requesting the change, then the employer has to make the request through a group communication. The group communication is defined as a communication to eligible employees. So to the extent that you're asking employees who are not currently working at the time when the shift is, to the extent that an employer is requesting employees who are not currently working to work additional shifts, the best practice is to communicate to all of the employees who could potentially work that shift in one communication and kind of make it a first come, first serve and have an opt-in procedure so that employees can clearly identify, hey, I've taken this shift. Or if not, that the manager can then communicate to the rest of the group, oh, this shift has been taken. It's no longer available. I think that there is some significant risk that employers need to consider related to this group communication, just practical implementation about if you're inviting a whole bunch of employees to sign up for a shift at once, how do you navigate who gets to accept that shift first and who and what if somebody comes in unexpectedly to fill that shift. So just a lot of things that employers need to think about as they're developing their own policy and procedure for filling open shifts. The right to rest. Leah is going to cover the right to rest.
So the right to rest between work shifts is a 10-hour right to rest. And even though the third bullet point here is the split shifts. Let me get my little arrow. Is this does not apply to split shifts. So this is something different. So the right to rest between shifts is says that unless the employer requests or consents to work such hours, the employer may not schedule or require an employee to work during one, the first 10 hours following the end of a previous calendar day's work or on-call shift, or the first 10 hours following the end of a work or on-call shift that spanned two calendar days. So basically, you have to give your employees at least 10 hours between shifts. And when that 10 hours starts is going to be depending upon whether the last shift spanned more than one day, which is probably pretty unusual, or did not. Now, if an employee works during the first 10-hour periods that I've just discussed, there are going to be penalties. And the penalty is that the employee must be compensated for each hour or portion of an hour that the employee works at a rate of time and a half, so it's like overtime, on their regular rate of pay. This premium pay provision does not apply to any hour or portion of an hour worked during which the employee is providing off-site repair assistance to a motorist. So this is a very specific limitation. So generally, if an employee works with it, does not have a 10-hour right to rest, even if they're consenting to it, then the employee must be compensated at time and a half during that period. So here we've talked about some of the penalties that can come up. Next, we're going to discuss what you can do or what you must do to be in compliance with the new regulations on predictive scheduling. The first one is that you need to have the poster that is put out by the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries, which can be found on BOLI, as we call its website. The next thing that you must do, which is going to be a little bit more difficult administratively, is you have to keep certain records that most of our clients, I would say, typically don't keep at this point in time. So what must you keep? What we're looking at here is these bullet points to the right. First, you must keep written work schedules provided to the employee and the posted written work schedules. So when you're issuing these advanced schedules, you need to keep a copy of those. Second, you need to keep copies of either your or the employee's written request to change the work schedule. Whether the request comes from the employee or the employer is critical, as you've heard from Brent. If you're getting an employee who's requesting that there's a change to their schedule, get it in writing. Whether that's an email, if your employees have email, whether that's on a post-it note, whether that's on some form that you create, which would be the best way to go, that then could go into their file, whatever it is, you need to keep a copy of that. The third thing that you need to keep records of is the good faith estimate of the employee's work schedule provided to any new employees. This, again, should be something that when it's given to them, it is dated and it goes in their personnel file. The fourth thing you must keep a copy of is a voluntary standby list and the notifications if you use a standby list. And we realize that most employers probably don't use a standby list, but if they do, then you need to keep a copy of those notifications as well as what those posted lists were for. If the employer is not able to post BOLI's poster, communications to the employee must be kept pursuant to ORS 653-460, subsection 2. Finally, documents that demonstrate the employer's just cause to subtract hours for disciplinary reasons. If you've heard any employment law topic before, you've probably heard us say record keeping, and making sure that you are having accurate record keeping of your employees' indiscretions. Then you need to make, this is one more reason why you need to be making sure to keep accurate records of whether there are attendance violations, whether there are disciplinary problems, and whether you're subtracting hours for this. Going back to what Brent was saying on the last few slides, the reasons why hours might be cut that are exempt from paying penalties, even if it's things like acts of nature, snowstorms, our practice tip is to always keep records of that. So if you need to keep your store closed on December 3rd, 4th, and 5th because of a snowstorm, have a record of that and have a communication to your employees that says that. All right, so the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industry's BOLI is going to be the body that enforces these regulations. BOLI enforcement begins on January 1st, 2019, so you've got really a year before they're going to start trying to enforce these penalties. That doesn't mean you want to wait, or not a year, half a year until they start trying to enforce these penalties. So that doesn't mean you want to wait until January 1st to start getting compliant, because there are going to be bumps along the road, and administratively, there's going to be things that you have to figure out. Do you want to prepare forms? Do you not want to prepare forms? How do you want to communicate to employees? Do you want to have a standby list? Do you not want to have a standby list? So start now in figuring out how you're going to comply with these new rules and regulations, and whether you are a covered entity and you have covered employees. So what are the penalties for violations? The penalties are monetary penalties. There's a penalty of up to $1,000 per violation. You can also be penalized for failing to display the poster. That's a $500 penalty. And there's a big penalty for coercing an employee to join a voluntary standby list. That's a $2,000 penalty. So again, this is where your record keeping of, there's a, you know, let's say somebody quits and you know you're going to have a few open shifts. This is where having those records where you have a communication that goes out to employees that says we're going to be needing coverage for Wednesday's the morning shift. You know, if you're interested, let us know. And you have that sort of documentation is going to be so important. Will each penalty be $1,000? Probably not. It's going to depend on the facts and circumstances of your situation and whether they're mitigating or aggravating circumstances. And what we mean by that is, was the employer making some attempt to comply, or is the employer a serial non-complier? If it's the latter, you're more likely to get the heavy fine. If it's the former, frankly, the first time, BOLI might just issue a warning letter before a penalty is assessed. So again, having your own documentation of what you are doing, when you are doing it, in order to try to understand these rules and complying, including keeping something in your record showing that you attended a conference like this or another conference, is going to be helpful. And then that something was carried out afterwards to ensure an attempt at compliance.
So what are some of the frequently asked questions that we're getting from employers about this law? The first question, I think, is that employers are trying to figure out when to give the good faith estimate of hours form, and they're rethinking about, you know, if they give all of their forms to the employee at the time of training, and the employee is receiving payment at that time, maybe the employee has already commenced employment for the purposes of this predictive scheduling law, and maybe that's a technical violation of the law. So I think that employers are really thinking really closely about making sure that that good faith estimate of hours form is delivered before the commencement of employment. The second question that I think a lot of employers are wrestling with is whether or not they should have a voluntary standby list. So I think employers are trying to decide if they want to go through the additional administrative hurdles of providing the notices required and doing the record keeping required to maintain the voluntary standby list. But I think that the flexibility that the voluntary standby list offers is pretty important. The voluntary standby list allows employers to contact individuals to request that those individuals come in to cover shifts, rather than making the group communication that we talked about under the Exemption K to cover unanticipated customer need or unexpected employee absence. So I think that the voluntary standby list does add some additional administrative hurdles, but I think in general that employers are concluding that the flexibility that the voluntary standby list offers for a last-minute schedule coverage is pretty important. The final question that we've been getting a lot, and unfortunately that we just don't have a really clear answer to, is how are we supposed to calculate the penalty wages? So if an employer makes multiple changes within the notice period, so for example, if they change the employee's schedule on day 5 and day 3 before the employee's shift, is that employee entitled to multiple penalty wages for each schedule change, or are the penalties calculated on a per shift basis? And we tried to, during the comment period for BOLI's rulemaking, we tried to nudge BOLI to move toward a per shift calculation rather than a per change calculation. As you can imagine, that's a lot easier for employers to track, and it's a lot more certain for employers. Well, BOLI added some additional language for the final rules, but I don't know that the additional language provided much more clarity. So I think in order to be safe right now, and the conservative approach is for employers to pay the penalty wages calculated on a per change basis. So every time the employer changes the employee's schedule without providing the advance notice required by the statute, that is subject to penalty wages. I think that obviously, a per-shift calculation is more favorable to employers, but I just wouldn't feel comfortable relying on that interpretation until it had been tested or until BOLI issued some more clarification on that point. I think that most employers are adapting their Seattle policies to try to comply with the new Oregon law. And I think that there's been some pretty good success about doing that. There are a lot of similarities between the Seattle Secure Scheduling Ordinance and the Oregon Predictive Scheduling Law. I think that there are two key differences that between the Seattle Ordinance and the Oregon law. And I think that those differences were kind of conscious choices that the Oregon legislature made looking at how Seattle's ordinances had been implemented and some of the problems that they were having. So for context, in Seattle, if you've got an unexpected customer need, it's okay to have there's a very limited slice of employees that you can ask to cover for those shifts. It has to be an in-person group communication. So you can only communicate to employees that are currently working a shift at the time, and it has to be for a same-day shift. So whereas the Oregon law provides employers with a lot of flexibility with respect to unanticipated customer needs, remember, it has to be unanticipated after the time the schedule was posted. In Seattle, by contrast, it's only for same-day unanticipated customer needs. So the Oregon law offers a lot more flexibility, and it's a lot more accommodating with respect to unanticipated customer needs. In Seattle, if you have an unexpected employee absence, the employee can cover that unavailability, but it must do so through a group communication. This is the mass communication exception, and it has to be to two or more people. So even if the employee absence, you've got somebody currently working a shift at the time who could cover for the employee absence, it still has to be a group communication to apply for this mass communication exception. So Oregon said, again, we're going to be more accommodating and we're going to allow more flexibility through Exemption K and through the voluntary standby list. So the voluntary standby list adds kind of an intermediate layer of here's a group of employees that self-select as saying, I want to be contacted first if additional shifts arise. So in order to maintain a voluntary standby list, employees have to sign up in writing, and there are certain disclosures that you have to make. A lot of our employers are creating voluntary standby list forms that include how to accept additional hours off the standby list, how, you know, checklists for managers about how to contact people off of the standby list. And these are something that vary employer to employer and really depend on the nature of your business and how you schedule and call in your employees. So the lessons that we've learned from Seattle, and if anybody has questions about Seattle, Laura Turchansky up in our Seattle office is our expert on the secure scheduling law for Seattle, and she is super helpful and super nice. So ask her if you have any questions about Seattle. But when I talked to her and I said, hey, Laura, what are the lessons that employers have learned, or what can we tell people in Oregon that we've learned from the predictive scheduling law? These were her 3 points. First, calculating the regular rate of pay can be really tricky. So if an employee works different jobs or has different job functions that entitle them to different rates of pay, then their regular rate of pay is going to be some kind of blend of those two rates. You need to look at the rules to make sure that you're accurately calculating that rate of pay. Similarly, it can be really tricky for employees who are based solely on commissions, although if employees only are if employees are based on a salary and supplemented with commissions, the rules are a little bit more forgiving and they're a little bit easier. But just note here, the regular rate of pay can be really tricky. So when you're paying that penalty wage is calculated at the regular rate of pay. What is that number? Look at the rules to determine a good way to figure out what the employee is titled to. Employers have to figure out documentation and record keeping. So the record keeping requirements can be fairly onerous. As Leah talked about, you have to keep all of the schedules. You have to keep all of the notices that you provide. There are a lot of additional paperwork that employers might be required to maintain here. Luckily, the law allows for electronic maintenance of those records, but just ensure that if you have an electronic backup in case something happens, because you are required to maintain those records for 3 years, and that's something that I think Laura has found in Seattle, is that when the Seattle Office of Labor Standards comes in to do an inspection, that's one of the first places they start, is they ask for your file and your record so that they can go through and do an audit of your scheduling practices. And so I think that employers need to be very careful to document. And that's why Leah mentioned the best practice is to just document everything so it's clear if you are audited that, hey, we've complied with the law and this is our records on that. Finally, and to aid in the documentation and record keeping, I think employers are finding it really helpful to create forms and templates. So the forms and templates that a lot of employers are creating are good faith estimate of hours form to give to new employees, voluntary standby list form for employees to sign up and to provide the required disclosures connected with the voluntary standby list, and finally, request forms. So if an employee requests to change their schedule, having some kind of form that they can fill out and hand to their manager to document that request. Those were Laura's big takeaways from the implementation of the Seattle law, and I think that they're really helpful for Oregon employers as they begin to think about the law. So last week, we're going to open it up to a few questions.
So we have some questions that came in. I'm going to handle the ones that came in early in excuse me, in the presentation. And there are a few of you who had the same or a similar type of question. And the first one dealt with the covered employee issue, and that is the HR manager really a covered employee, or are they not a covered employee? And what if that person is the HR manager, but they are non-exempt? What do you do? So the test for who's a covered employee, there's two parts to it. One is if an employee is exempt under the administrative or professional or executive exemption, they are not a covered employee. So your top level management is not going to be a covered employee. Your salaried people who fall into one of those exemptions is not going to be an employee. The other people who are going to fall into the not covered employee are people who perform services for the company, like a payroll clerk or a bookkeeper or a human resources manager, that aren't going to essentially the core business of the company. So, for example, let's say you have an employer that operates a chain of restaurants. They're going to have servers, cooks, bartenders, dishwashers, people who prepare and serve the food. All of those employees are going to be considered covered employees for that company. However, the payroll clerk or the human resources specialist is carrying out a different function, so those are not going to be covered employees for that company. Now, if you have this situation, you know, conceivably could be different depending on some unique business, but basically it's employees who are carrying out the purpose of that business. So if it's retail, the people who are on the floor. If it's food service, the people who are cooking, making, cleaning up the food, that sort of thing. So it's really a primary duty sort of test. So that hopefully answers those couple of questions we got there. The second question we got early on was, what is this whole integrated enterprise about? So the integrated enterprise issue is for purposes of counting your employees, your 500 employees. And what the law says is, if you have two separate entities, two separate businesses that really are a single employer, then they are an integrated enterprise, and you'd have to count all the employees to see whether you get to that 500. There are several factors that the rules, the regulations list as being possible examples of when you have two businesses that are so intertwined that they're an integrated enterprise. But generally, it's one in which the operations are intertwined to such a degree that they can be considered a single employer, such as the interrelation between sharing management services, check writing, preparation of mutual policies, sharing of payroll services, those centralized control of labor relations, common ownership, or financial control. That's when you would end up with an integrated enterprise. And that's, again, for purposes of counting your 500 employees. The other very unique question that I wanted to get to was, somebody had a question about wine tasting rooms. Is the wine tasting room going to be considered a covered employer? And the answer to that question is most likely yes. Although a winery does not fall within the NAICS classification system that we're looking for, because it's an agricultural and it falls under Section 312130, there have been at least two situations in other states where they've said wine tasting rooms either fall into the Section 44, which is retail, because you're selling wine or maybe other sorts of wine-related products, glasses, wine glasses, trinkets, books on wine there, or Section 722, which is a drinking place. So those employees who work in your wine tasting room are going to be covered.
There were some additional questions about automotive dealerships and whether they needed to follow this law. I think that I would check to see whether you fall under the NAICS retail classification, but without looking, I have a hunch that auto dealerships probably do fall under that classification, and that would be something to follow up with an attorney to get some certain clarification on that. Similarly, for I think the wireless cell phone business question, that's a similar answer as to what Leah just gave with respect to the wineries. To the extent that you've got a retail location, that would be covered.
But in that situation, the engineers, and I don't know for the person who gave us the question on that, I don't know if the engineers means somebody who's out in the field, fixing lines or something like that, if that person would not probably be covered. They'd be more like an HR manager or a payroll person. But if the engineer is somebody who is assisting with how the phones work or troubleshooting, then they're definitely more likely to be considered covered.
I think that the next couple of questions relate to the median number of hours. And the first question is, would including the median number of hours and so forth be acceptable to be included on the signed offer letter? You know, I think that that's a difficult question because the law defines time of hire. We can go back to that slide real quick, but the law defines time of hire to be after an offer of employment and the acceptance of the offer. However, I think that if the estimate of hours was on the signed offer letter, I would have a hard time seeing BOLI enforcing penalties for that. But as just a technical matter, I don't know that that complies with the technical way that the law is written.
And I'm going to cover the next question. There was a question about what about management trainees? Are they covered or not? Since management, if they're truly exempt managers, then they're not covered. Typically, we advise our clients not to have management trainees classified as exempt, but to have them hourly because they're very often fulfilling hourly type job functions and they're not exercising their own discretion and control, so they really don't fall into one of the exemptions. So as a practical matter, your management trainees are still hourly non-exempt employees, and if they are hourly non-exempt employees, then they're going to fall into the covered employees for the purposes of predictive scheduling. There was also a question about the right to rest and how it applies to split shifts. So a split shift is a shift where the employee in Oregon, a split shift is a shift where the employee is actually scheduled to leave work for a time that is not meant to be their meal and rest period and come back. So let's say you have a restaurant, you have your busy time from 9 to 11, and then your next busy time is from at dinner time from 4 to 7. That would be that employee's shift for that day. That would be considered a split shift because it's actually the shift for the day. So in that situation, you would not have the requirement of the 10 hours rest between. However, where you would have the requirement of the 10 hours is following the conclusion of the second part of the split shift to the shift the next day. So you would want to make sure that the employee gets their time off from their 10 hours off for the split shift.
There were some additional questions about the good faith estimate of hours, and what if, for example, you say that the employee will work 60 hours in the first month, but then it turns out that they only work 55. Is that a violation of the law? I don't think so. I think that as long as the estimate is a good faith estimate of the number of hours, that you'll be fine. And I think that the way that you demonstrate that it's a good faith estimate of hours is that you base that estimate of hours on objective criteria. So what are people that have worked in the same position during a similar period of time, what does their schedule look like? What is the median number of hours that all of those employees have worked? And that will tell you the objective median number that you then are required to put on your good faith estimate form.
The next question that we can take a look at, and I know we're rapidly approaching the end of our hour, and there are actually quite a few more questions. As I'm sure you can all tell, this is a complicated area, and to be frank with you, based on our discussions with BOLI, not everything and many of your good questions have not been fully fleshed out by the agency, and that's going to take some more time, and we are continuing to work with BOLI. So if you have questions that don't get answered today, please follow up with either Brent or myself so so that we can take those questions in and continue to try to get practical answers for all of you employers. One of the questions was, how does this work with positions that don't have a scheduled end time? For example, the housekeeping department is done when their list of rooms are cleaned. If there are several rooms that require no cleaning that day, will they be finished sooner? This is going to be difficult. And frankly, what you're going to have to do is come up with a schedule that is your, you know, sort of your best estimate of when they work and have them follow that schedule. So that does create liability for an employer that doesn't have open or that has open-ended schedules, because there's Brenda, you in there? He's got the statute in front of him. He's going to go ahead and read that to you.
Yeah. So actually, the advance notice requirement, as clarified in the final rules that Boley published, requires that a schedule include both a specific start and end time for the work period. So unfortunately, you're going to have to list on the schedule an end time for the employee going forward. And, you know, I realize that that's probably contrary to your practices, the question gets at, but, you know, that's just what the new rule is going to require.
Okay, well, it looks like I see there's still several questions. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to be able to get to them. Some of them deal with when will Boley clarify which employers are covered. If you have questions about whether your employer is covered, I would suggest you do talk to your employment counsel. Brett and I are happy to answer those questions as a follow-up since we're running out of time, because sometimes it does take some uncovering. For the person who works at the assisted living facility, you know, this is similar to the hospital example that is given in the rules, where, you know, there may be food service, which wouldn't necessarily mean that there's coverage for the entire hospital, but it may be for specific aspects of the business that there are covered employees. But again, that's going to be a more fact-specific question that we're going to either us or somebody else should really have your lawyer, your employment lawyers, assist you, whether that's in-house or outside counsel, with drilling down on who is covered and who is not, and keep records of your efforts to do so, because that would be a mitigating factor going towards whether you're going to be penalized or not. So we hope this was helpful to everybody. We look forward to your questions. Please don't hesitate to contact Brent or myself about this, and we will continue to post updates on changes that are made to the rules and regulations as they come along. So if you're not receiving updates from Davis Wright Tremaine and you would like to, please make sure to go to our website and sign up for those. And otherwise, that concludes our webinar for today.
Thank you so much. For our participants, a link to an online evaluation is now displayed on your screen. Please take a few moments to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.